As I've reread, I've talked about the importance of rereading. And there are some things I've noted as I've been rereading or reading a commentary and had somebody else point this out to me that I think are well worth kind of reflecting on. So we go back to chapter 7 for a moment. 1 Samuel chapter 7. This is after the ark has returned, right? And now there's a military conflict. And so Samuel is there. And if we skim over that chapter, just in your own Bibles, we'll take a minute or two. What does Samuel not do? It tells us at the end of the chapter, Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life, and he goes on this circuit, although all of the places it talks about him going to are within a day's walk of his hometown at Ramah, so he doesn't really move around all that much. But reflect on the rest of the chapter and think about how Samuel compares to the judges back in the book of Judges. What does Samuel not do? It's very interesting. I had to have this pointed out to me, so don't feel bad if you don't notice it. Also, you're noticing something that's not there, which is always harder. Yeah. This is true, yeah. It's like the none of the above on a multiple choice test, right? It's like I thought I knew the answer, and now I'm afraid to fill in the bubble. Well, what do most of the judges do in the book of Judges? Let's ask it this way. Some of them, actually not that many of them, some of them adjudicate things. So Deborah does, for instance. And Deborah and then Samuel actually are the only ones called judges in the text. Usually it refers to them judging with the verb form. So they do, some of them judge, as in they adjudicate cases, they make decisions, they act as administrative leaders, but what do most of them also do? Think of Gideon or Ehud or Shamgar. Yes, some sort of military leadership. They lead Israel into battle. They serve as generals, as it were. If we look over chapter 7, which is the main place we see Samuel in action, 7 and 8, he's there and he's providing leadership at the site of the battle, but he doesn't lead Israel into battle. Who does? The Lord. The Lord leads them into battle. Which makes the shape of their request in chapter 8, it sharpens it a bit. Because they ask for a king to, in verse 6, what? Sorry, chapter 8, verse 6. But the thing, verse 5 actually is their request. Behold, you are old and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint for us a king to judge us like all the nations. And in particular, they seem to want one who will lead them into battle. They make this clear in verses 19 and 20, after Samuel has described what this king will be like. They want one who will judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. We've already talked about how the text makes clear that's something Yahweh does, right? Exodus 14, Deuteronomy 1, Deuteronomy 3, throughout Joshua, although it's never described that way in Judges. But that, which is something Samuel doesn't do as judge, is a key part of what they want in a king who will judge them. Also, something that's worth noting, there in chapter 8, so that's these two things. Samuel doesn't lead them militarily, but that is a key part of what they want in chapter 8. In Samuel's warning about kings, which is chapter 8, beginning at verse 10, what's the key verb in that section? This is for you libertarians in the room. From verse 10 on, what's the chief, so 10 to 18, what's the primary thing a king will do, as Samuel describes it to them? Take, in the form of taxation, but more than taxation, taxation of people, as well as things and wealth, is take. These will be the ways, verse 11, these will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons, right? Verse 13, he will take your daughters. Verse 14, he will take the best of your fields. Verse 15, he will take the tenth. 17, he will take the tenth of something else, right? And in that day, you will cry out. Verse 18, because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves. But the Lord will not answer you in that day. And the crying out is described as a crying out as the result of oppression, right? Which is why they cry out in the book of Judges, but it's because of the oppression of a foreign power. But here they'll be crying out because of their own king that they have chosen. But the Lord will not answer them. And then another, what's not here. If you look over chapter 9, think about the lead up to chapter 9, right? The Lord knows that they're going to ask for a king. The Lord is arranging things so that a king will be given them. What word is absent from chapter 9? And chapter 10, actually, right? Because this continues up to the middle of chapter 10 until the people are gathered, right? There's a word or a group of words we expect, but we don't meet it anywhere in this section until finally we get to chapter 10, verse 16. And it's in reference to what he does not say to his uncle. Sure, Saul keeps his mouth shut about what Samuel said, except in relation to the donkeys. What else is not there? What does the narrator withhold from us? What words would we expect to see in this chapter that aren't there? What's the chapter about? What's this section about? Saul being chosen as the king is precisely what's absent. The word for king is never used. Kingdom as a word is not mentioned until the very end of that section there, right? It's very, very interesting. very interesting. And in the midst of that, look at how David first phrased it here. The text is filled with ambiguities that are deliberate. Right? There are things that are left open. Things that could be taken more than one way that are not clarified for us. They may become clear as we continue to read. How does he phrase it here? I've lost my bookmark that marked that. It never says in the text, in these sections we've read, that the Lord has appointed Saul as king. The word that's used for prince, let's see where it went. In chapter 9, verse 16. It doesn't say anointed king. It doesn't say anointed king. And if you're reading the ESV, there's a little footnote there on the word prince where it says leader. This word, Nagiv, could mean anything from the leader of a clan up to the leader of a nation. It's a highly ambiguous word. Yeah, the headings there keep us from noticing some of the delicate restraint of the narrator. So these headings are really helpful for helping us kind of find our place quickly, right? When we're looking for a specific section, or if we're skimming the text, getting a sense of what's going on. But sometimes they keep us from noticing the nuances or the restraint that the narrator shows. It's very, very interesting that the word king is left out of this section, and that we're never told directly in the text, either by one of the characters or by the narrator, that the Lord appoints Saul as king. I think later, we'll see if that restraint continues, right? It may become...
That's the question.
What's the significance of that? Here in this place, where they've just asked for a king, and we get this guy whose name means asked for, and he's anointed to be a leader, everything seems to indicate that this is the guy that answers the people's request and is also the one that the Lord has been intending to put in this position from the first whisperings of monarchy early on. But then there are these things. There are these things that give us pause. There are these things that leave us scratching our head, right? Like where he's from. And more on that, right? If you go back and read the end of Judges, we've already mentioned that he's from Gibeah, which is the town that causes the civil war that leaves the tribe that he's from almost wiped out. Which also means, by the way, that his parentage is almost certainly the result of this questionable way of getting wives for the rest of Benjamin by kidnapping these women during the feast. And then it's never stated here in this section where he's drawn out that the Lord has appointed him king. The word king is not used in this section up until, I think it is used by the people at the last half of chapter 10. It'd be interesting. Let's read that together and see if it's used by the narrator or by Saul. Sorry, by the narrator or by Samuel, or if it's only used by the people in their speech. That might be worth noting. So chapter 10, verse 17. Now Samuel called the people together to the Lord at Mizpah, and he said to the people of Israel, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, I brought up Israel out of Egypt, and I delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of all the kingdoms that were oppressing you. But today you have rejected your God who saves you from all your calamities and your distresses. And you have said to him, set a king over us. Now therefore present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and by your thousands." Then Samuel brought all the tribes of Israel near, and the tribe of Benjamin was taken by lot. He brought the tribe of Benjamin near by its clans, and the clan of the Matrites was taken by lot. And Saul, the son of Kish, was taken by lot. And when they sought him, he could not be found. So they inquired again of the Lord, "Is there a man still to come?" And the Lord said, "Behold, he has hidden himself among the baggage." Then they ran and took him from there. And when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. And Samuel said to all the people, "Do you see him whom the Lord has chosen?" There is none like him among all the people. And all the people shouted, "Long live the king." Then Samuel told the people the rights and duties of the kingship, and he wrote them in a book and laid it up before the Lord. Then Samuel sent all the people away, each one to his home. Saul also went to his home at Gibeah, and with him went the men of valor whose hearts God had touched. But some worthless fellows said, "How can this man save us?" And they despised him and brought him no present, but he held his peace. So he is referred to by Samuel as the one the Lord has chosen, which is clear with the taking of lots, right? That's a way of making sure that we get the Lord's choice rather than our choice. We should do that more, right? That's biblical decision-making right there. But even there, Samuel doesn't call him the one the Lord has chosen as king. It's a great deal of restraint in what is said and nuance in how it's said. I'm going to punt on that, and I'm going to leave it to Mike. But I would say the Old Testament view of, which we see in Proverbs, for instance, the idea of casting lots, is that the Lord is in control of how the casting of lots comes out. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The casting of lots, I know, is something I never see directly criticized as you should do this differently, right? Or should understand this in another way. I think part of the difficulty with Gideon is that he sets things up for the Lord to decide, and he gets the answer, and then he wants to do it again, as though he's not sure. Yeah. We'll flip a coin. I meant heads. Let's flip again. Right. So. Yeah. There's so much here, and there's so much that you notice on a rereading, and there's so much that, honestly, I need to have somebody else point out to me. And then once they have, I'm like, how did I not see that? Yeah. I think it was Spurgeon who first described the Bible as a book that grows with you. Yes. Yeah. It's true, too. I think we see in this the importance of reading in community. So I initially read chapter 8, as you well know, because you pushed back rather strongly against me. I read it as critical of Samuel. And I do still think that there is some criticism of Samuel there. But I think it's not as sharp as I initially read it. One of the things that David first pointed out in his commentary is, we commented on how the narrator doesn't spend a lot of time developing this thing with his sons. He just points it out. And it may be a nod to Samuel's discipline of his sons that the place in which they're ministering, right, is like way out on the frontier. He's kind of sent them to the outskirts. And so that may have been a way both of disciplining them and also kind of managing the damage that they're able to do by putting them in this remote location in Beersheba. So I appreciate the reading together, and you guys see things I don't see, and you also will kind of give me looks or furrow your brows or be like, hold on a second. And that's one of the ways we become better readers, is by reading together and seeing things. There are things that each of us bring to the table as we read, past experiences, existing impressions of things that cause us to pick up on details that others don't, as well as be challenged in ways that others aren't or would be if we brought some of these things with us. So thank you for that. Let's see, I noticed all of you with first pointing them out to me. There are so many things I saw here that I didn't before. Let's see. Absolutely, yes. Right. So what's the significance? Right. Because we're set up to expect a king. Samuel's given instructions to choose a king. But now we get this section where clearly we think this is the guy who gets the job. But the word king is not used by the narrator. The reign, the verb for reign or rule over is not used by the narrator. Restrain is in chapter 9. But what's going on there? I don't think we're to take from that that Saul should not be viewed as the first king. But I do think it contributes to those flashing neon question marks that are hanging over Saul from the very, very beginning. From the first mention of his father's lineage, right? Alarm bells should be going off. And then there's this hilarious parody of him. The way first phrases it, he goes looking for his donkeys and finds a kingdom. But in the midst of that, he still can't find his donkeys. He points out that there's this implicit critique there, right? One of the expectations of a king is that they would shepherd God's people, Israel, and yet he can't manage these large beasts who manage to find their way home without him. So I don't think that we're meant to understand that Saul is not the first king or that he's wrongfully chosen. But I think the narrator's restraint there just contributes to those alarm bells that should be going off as we read this section. Yes, the Lord wants to move us toward a monarchy. Yes, Saul is the first step in that. But is Saul what we're looking for? That's not allowed. That's not allowed. You have to leave. Sorry. You can't read ahead.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And clearly displeased the Lord and displeased Samuel, and they want a king like the nation.
Mm-hmm.
So God's going to give them a king like the nation to show as kind of a, you got what you asked for. And then he brings David later and says, mm-hmm.
Yes, you know, I almost want to say that Saul is the king they deserve.
Yes. Yes.
Whereas David's the king they really need right now. Except we get into David, and one of the things that we'll see is that although David is described as the one after the Lord's heart, we read the rest of the narrative of David, and that leaves us, we reread that and we wonder, does that mean that David really loves the Lord and wants what the Lord wants? Or does that simply mean that David is the one that the Lord has chosen? Because David has such a checkered character himself. Although he responds differently in light of that sin, right? Judas and Peter as a comparison. David responds to conviction with repentance, whereas Saul responds to conviction with denial and excuses and blame shifting. And we'll see more of that as we go. Both deeply flawed men. Although Saul is, in a sense, everything you want as a leader. Especially if you're one of the people and not a reader and you're not privy to this background information of, you know, he can't find his own donkeys and all of that. He's tall. He's charming. He's handsome. These people offend him and he holds his peace, right? He's able to lead the nation militarily and get them to rally around him. He's a charismatic leader. And to circle back, quite a handsome fellow, right? And he wins. He wins. I mean, what more do you want? As the narrative proceeds, we'll see deeply troubling things. But on the surface, you know, he's quite the guy.
Tony.
Yeah. We'll talk about it more when we come to it. Yeah, this reference to David. Yeah. 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 This ambiguity there that's, as the text bears out, which direction does it bear? Or is it both? This is the one who is according to the Lord's choice. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. How are we doing on time? We have 15 minutes. Shall we read chapter 11 together? All right. So with all that as background and a refresher of what we've seen or might have seen as we read, we come to chapter 11 and verse 1. Then Nahash the Ammonite went up and besieged Jabesh-Gilead. And all the men of Jabesh said to Nahash, make a treaty with us, and we will serve you. But Nahash the Ammonite said to them, on this condition I will make a treaty with you, that I gouge out all your right eyes, and thus bring disgrace on all Israel. The elders of Jabesh said to him, give us 7 days respite, that we may send messengers through all the territory of Israel. Then if there is no one to save us, we will give ourselves up to you. When the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul, they reported the matter in the ears of the people, and all the people wept aloud. You've got to wonder about the Ammonites at this point. Why did they allow this? They must have been awfully confident. Or perhaps it sounded to them as though, you know, 7 days with no deliverer, and after all, it's Israel we're talking about, right? They'll just walk out and let us do this to them. So why bother tearing down the walls of the city, right? But it's very interesting. Their assent is not noted, except insofar as messengers reach Saul about this. When the messengers came to Gibeah of Saul, they reported the matter, verse 4, in the ears of the people, and all the people wept aloud. Now behold, Saul was coming from the field behind the oxen. Very kingly occupation there. And Saul said, "What is wrong with the people that they are weeping?" So they told him the news of the men of Jabesh, and the Spirit of God rushed upon Saul when he heard these words. And his anger was greatly kindled. He took a yoke of oxen and cut them in pieces and sent them throughout all the territory of Israel by the hand of messengers, saying, "Whoever does not come out after Saul and Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen." Then the dread of the Lord fell upon the people, and they came out as one man. When he mustered them at Bezek, the people of Israel were 300,000, and the men of Judah 30,000. And they said to the messengers who had come, "Thus shall you say to the men of Jabesh Gilead, tomorrow, by the time the sun is hot, you shall have salvation." When the messengers came and told the men of Jabesh, they were glad. Therefore the men of Jabesh said, "Tomorrow we will give ourselves up to you, and you may do to us whatever seems good to you." And the next day Saul put the people in three companies, and they came into the midst of the camp in the morning watch and struck down the Ammonites until the heat of the day. And those who survived were scattered, so that no two of them were left together. Then the people said to Samuel, "Who is it that said, 'Shall Saul reign over us? Bring the men that we may put them to death.'" But Saul said, "Not a man shall be put to death this day, for today the Lord has worked salvation in Israel." Then Samuel said to the people, "Come, let us go to Gilgal and there renew the kingdom." So all the people went to Gilgal, and there they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. There they sacrificed peace offerings before the Lord, and there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. What do you notice in this chapter? There's a key thing that happens to Saul that should remind us of Judges. The Spirit of the Lord rushes upon him. That's the moment in the book of Judges when a judge is empowered to deliver the people, which we see at several points. Here it happens to Saul, which results in, right, this great military deliverance. What else do you notice? Do you find the manner of his persuasion troubling at all? Sorry? Saul. The manner in which he persuades the people to come to war. I find that a little troubling. It is quite effective. It's quite effective. He's a man who gets things done, right? Yeah. Well, it's not a dozen roses on the doorstep in the morning, right? But same message. It does. It does sound a lot like how Israel is gathered for war against Benjamin. We have oxen, and the threat here, as stated, although perhaps not as implied, is toward people's livestock rather than toward people. But it does remind us again of the end of the book of Judges. Yeah. And again, it's effective. They all come.
It's important to note that
Yeah.
Well, yeah,
that does. It does happen after the Spirit of God rushed upon Saul. When he heard these words, and his anger was greatly kindled. That's the first thing he does after that. And it's interesting, too, that it doesn't say the dread of Saul fell upon the people, but dread of the Lord fell upon them. Do you notice anything in verse 8 that's interesting? Israel and Judah are mentioned separately. The division of the kingdom, if you remember, doesn't come about until Rehoboam, right? After the death of Solomon. But it's mentioned here, which I think gives us a hint of two things. One, it's very possible that the book of Samuel is narrated to an audience that lives in the reality of the divided kingdom. For them, it's very possible that for the first audience of Samuel, this division between Israel and Judah is a reality. But I think it also hints, even if it doesn't tell us that much, it hints that this division between Judah and the other tribes goes back very, very early. And Rose observed the other day that Judah leads the charge against Benjamin in the civil war at the end of the book of Judges. So from very, very early on in Israel's history and throughout this period of kind of the development of the monarchy, there's already this deep, deep tension. It's almost like it's Judah versus the world. Which explains, I think at least in part, something we'll see later as David rises to the kingship. Of course, David is from Judah. But there's more to it than just he's one of our own. When Judah accepts him well before the rest of Israel does. So. What else do you see? Yeah, what's up with their right eyes being gouged out? Does that connect to earlier? I don't know. I don't know if it does, but that's a good question. Here it's connected directly to humiliation.
One of the explanations in the commentary I read was that if the right eye is gone, they're blind, they hold their view.
Yeah, if you're right eye dominant, right, then that would have a severe impact on your effectiveness with a bow and arrow or throwing a spear, among other things. Yeah. Sorry, Rose, did you have a... This is true, yeah. Perhaps so. So does this tension between Judah and his brothers go all the way back to the Joseph story? Perhaps implicit in the role that Judah takes, but brought to a head in the blessing that Jacob pronounces. And the shape that that takes, right? The other brothers are passed over. Those who were born before him are passed over for various reasons, right? But then it's not given to Ephraim and Manasseh either. The special position of leadership in the tribes is given to Judah in Jacob's blessing. If you remember, the brothers who were born earlier are Reuben, Simeon, and Levi. Reuben slept with his father's concubine. He's firstborn, but then he goes and does that. Simeon and Levi are the brothers who caused them trouble at Shechem. Right? Because in their anger, they lead the charge in going and slaughtering the Shechemites as they're recovering from the circumcision that they had talked them into doing as vengeance for Dinah. So perhaps that raises questions about their leadership and whether they should. But at any rate, the leadership is placed on the shoulders of Judah in Jacob's blessing. And he does say expressly, the scepter shall not depart from Judah until, and then the rest of the verse is famously difficult to understand. So, good question. So, there at the end of the chapter, right? They all go to Gilgal. They made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. There they sacrificed peace offerings before the Lord. And there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. Good question. Why a peace offering there? Right, so a peace offering is not connected with the end of a war per se. It is part of fellowship with God. Why that particular offering here? Good question. We'll see if you have one next week. Right? One other thing that I would point out in this chapter. Saul's already king, right? Like, this is weird. Did the people forget what had happened just before this? Although we don't meet Saul, you know, in his palace ruling over subjects either. We meet him in the field, behind a yoke of oxen, right? Driving a plow. There does seem to be this pattern, and the order is not the same, but the steps are the same, both with Saul and with David, where there's a private anointing, and then there's a public recognition, but then there's some kind of military victory that kind of puts a stamp of confirmation on the whole thing. And here with Saul, it's in that order. We get the private anointing, chapter 9 and 10. We get the public recognition at the end of chapter 10, although there's this murmuring against that decision. And in chapter 11, we get this military victory where the Spirit of the Lord rushes upon him. The order is different with David. We get the private anointing, then we get the military victory, and the public recognition is long delayed, although there is some public recognition that comes with the military victory, which is why he's no longer safe with Saul. Talk about that more as we get there. Very interesting. All right, let's head into chapter 12 and such as we continue. We're at time now. Any last questions? All right. Thank you.